Hello everyone, welcome to another brand new episode of Retro Asylum. We're here with Greg Caldwell. He's the co-founder of Retrotainment Games. So Greg, tell us, what is Retrotainment Games and what does it do?
First of all, thanks Chris for having me on. Yeah. Retrotainment Games is a business that myself and my best friend and business partner Tim Hartman started a couple years ago, when we stumbled upon the Nintendo Age website and NES Dev websites and found that people were making new NES games, and it was something that we had always dreamed of doing, and we saw that it was actually possible to do. So we just started digging in, starting where most people start, I think, with Nerdy Knights on Nintendo Age, and started learning all the restrictions of the NES and how to code and just like what this whole thing was about. And we've just built upon that ever since, and to get to the point where we are with our two releases, Haunted Halloween 85 and the sequel, Haunted Halloween 86, The Curse of Possum Hollow.
Yeah, I've played the second one. Extensively, cool. And on my PC actually. Sorry, I know everyone. You can play this on on Steam, and it's only about £2.50. It's brilliant, and it's worked perfectly fine. And I mean, I do have a NES, but it's a PAL NES, and I have to buy the. I understand your carts actually support any region, so like the old days, when you had to have region locks and stuff, and PAL versus NTSC, that old fight. It was a fight between right. The two regions. And it's wonderful that, I mean, you here you are, you're making these games on these old systems, and you sort of suddenly realized that you weren't alone in this desire. Like, wait, people still making games for insert old dead system in inverted commas. There's people still making games on the Dreamcast. They're still making games for Spectrum, of course, Commodore 64. There's people making, you know, updates or making ports of Commodore 64 games, like, or of current games. So, you know, Cannibalt was ported onto the Commodore 64. It's like it's quite an old game now, but it's you know, as far as it's here we have a mobile game ported onto an 8-bit system. It converts remarkably well, and I understand that you're focused on the NES for obvious reasons, because you know North America, you really really embrace the NES, whereas now know, and it's wonderful to hear this, and I've known this about 5 or 10 years, and you and Greg, you actually said this, like, oh yeah, we know that Europe didn't do this. You now know that Europe didn't embrace the NES. You knew we were doing something, but that you really weren't conscious of like what we were doing. And now you now know. It's wonderful that this, the retro community in North America and Europe has become much more unified than ever before. Would you agree?
I think without a doubt. And I love the fact that people are doing this for other consoles, C64 and the ZX Spectrum, or you guys call it the Speccy or something like that. But yeah, it's fantastic. I wish the ZX Spectrum is one console that I've never had. I'd love to get my hands on one and see some of the work that people are doing on that console, because it's fantastic to see it happening across the board. Like you said about people doing different things with it, whether you're porting a new game to an old console or like a D-Make style. If you're porting a game from an even older console, like 2600 to something like the NES, you know, there's room for all of this stuff, and I think there's a desire to see it all, be it like a one person show where they're making a homebrew totally from scratch, or a team of people that's making something totally from scratch, or spiritual successors, or like we said, ports. Like it's all out there, and it's all great to see.
Absolutely. And what's really, really interesting is that when people say, oh, I'd love to write code or make games for these old platforms, and so, and then they immediately go, okay, I can use some high-level languages. No. What have I got to do? See that string of numbers there? Actually, there's some numbers and there might be some letters.
Right.
Maybe from A to F. See that?
Yeah.
That's it. That's what you got to type. What's this gibberish? Yeah, but not to a computer, isn't.
Yeah. That's where we were when we started. I had no idea that you could use an A to represent a number.
Yeah.
You know, we had no idea what hex code was or any of that. So it was all totally new.
Exactly. And because, and I just find, I mean, I do code myself, but only high level stuff like C++ and stuff.
Okay.
I mean,
okay.
when I was much younger, I remember learning BASIC on various computers. It wasn't just the Spectrum. It was on other machines, because that's what we did in Europe. We had loads mm-hmm. of computers. We didn't have that many of us that have consoles in front of our TVs. We had computers in front of our TVs. And
right.
Because of that, we had these little keyboards. And some computers are better than others in programming. And what was really interesting, and it's something I learned very young at the time, but now it's quite a valuable lesson, is that all computers are is a bunch of switches. Ultimately.
Certainly, yeah.
Even now, they're just a bunch of switches. And
lots and lots of them.
Lots and lots of switches that overlay and overlay. If you get enough of them, you make these extraordinarily complex things that we now use and love and what have you to this day. But all it is just that still, even now, still just a bunch of switches. And what you're doing with what we're talking about is assembly, what's now known as assembly. Back in the 80s, it was called machine code, or machine language. Mm-hmm. And it was called that because you're talking directly to the hardware. You're basically saying, and it's still Boolean logic. It's still if and or else, right? It's still mm-hmm. that. And you're basically saying, if that part of the memory is that number, then you must be that number or that thing. Or that's it. And that creates this phenomenally powerful. It's phenomenally powerful once you get your head around that. And that's what you've had to do with the NES, isn't it? That's what you had to do. You realize you had to, more or less. I mean, there are some custom chips inside, isn't there?
Well, yeah, but like you're saying, you're coding specifically for the 6502 chip. And this is something that I had no idea going into this. But I guess kind of fortunately, I had never worked with any higher level language at all. So learning assembly language, it wasn't like I was learning it with a friend, and he codes in several different languages, and he's like, "What? Where is all this? Like, what is going on? This doesn't make any sense." And for me, it was, I guess, a little bit more intuitive because I didn't have those roadblocks. I wasn't thinking, "Why can't it do this? Why can't it do that?" It was just like, "Oh, this is what I have to learn."
Yeah.
But let me be perfectly clear: I only learned the basics of the 6502 assembly language. Our main programmer, Damian Yarek, also goes by Tepples Online. He's the one that does all of the heavy lifting. Like, he's the man that really knows the code. And from what I can tell, he knows it as good or better than anyone else.
Yes. And what the 6502 is also in the Commodore 64. And I think
Commodore 64, Atari, and also the Terminator.
The what?
Terminator. It's like a cute little fact on the original Terminator series. He's when you see his the view from his first person perspective, you can see some assembly code running on the side there.
And it's also on the BBC Micro, I believe, as well. There you go. That's
okay.
Thing. So it's also in there. But and then the other chip that I'm more familiar with is the Z80 or the Z80, if you will.
Okay.
Zilog 80. That's the CPU I'm more familiar with. They are very.
And you've coded for this? Like you said, you do modern language, but have you also coded for any of these older consoles?
Yes. So I only did some stuff back in when I was very very young in the 80s, and from when I was a teenager up to like the early 90s when I did some. I wrote some rudimentary stuff, and then I got distracted by things, something shiny, and okay. I pursued a very specific career that's completely separate from computers. In fact, it uses computers as a tool. It doesn't use them as a core sort of like profession or thing. You can, in fact, my job I can do without one. I still have a huge sort of passion and fascination for computing language. And I still know how to, and I use them as a tool, really. But the trick is that although the Z80 or the Z80, if you will, and the Zilog 80 and the 6502 were very competitive processors, and they competed each other, and they both had their strengths and weaknesses, just a bit like AMD and Intel, a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean,
the big difference is that one was completely incompatible with the other.
Right. Again, something that I learned along the way, I assumed, oh, you learn an assembly language, it carries over to any chip like that. But no, that's not the case at all.
No. The actual design, the core design of 6502 is very, very different. And in fact, I read there's a book about the rise and fall of Commodore, who actually developed this particular chip. MOS Technologies developed this chip.
Right.
And the story behind its creation is, how did they make it at all? They seem to be making it up as they go along, and they were.
Yeah.
That people still do. That's what people don't understand about the world. We just keep on making it up as we go along. And that's what for the most part.
From what I understood, there was sort of a split, and a couple people branched off and started working on the specialized, the MOS 6502, and that they made a few adjustments to some of the logic from previous chips, and it was just, it seemed to fit perfectly with what Nintendo was doing. So they jumped on it, and that was it.
Absolutely. And but going on to the NES, or the NES, or whatever you want to call it, Nintendo Entertainment System, the gray box, as we all know, at least we're
the gray box, the toaster, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, not the Famicom, which is related to it, very, very, very closely related to it, but it's not the same. I understand, it's not the same quite.
There are there's a few differences, mainly in the sound.
Yes, yes, and so here we have a console that's way more powerful than I gave it credit, because by the time it arrived in the UK, I was deep in Amiga land. Okay, I was just awash with Amiga games and 16-bit titles, and that's what I was all about at the time.
Yeah.
And quite frankly, if you were in my position, if you were in the UK, you would have done the same. You're like, oh yeah, and then the NES arrived, and everyone's banging on about how amazing Mario was, and like, true. It is an amazing platformer. It still is to this day, as we all know. Odyssey. Yeah, it's just like, good God, you know, what a heritage that game has. But it was a hard sell over here, and so we missed out on this machine because we then also had the Sega Master System as well. I know.
Right.
I know. there were some great games on the Master System, don't get me wrong. Absolutely, there's some fantastic games on the Sega Master System, but it wasn't the NES. But for some reason,
just
embraced that machine.
Yeah, and that's the console that Tim actually grew up with.
Right.
When his dad went to buy him a Christmas gift, an NES.
Yes.
One of the employees at a toy store actually that was selling them convinced him to buy the Sega. Told him that the Master System was better, and Tim.
Well, technically,
he was like,
it is
grateful to get it. Yeah. And Tim was grateful to get it, but it was like, you know, all of my friends have the NES. Like now, I can't trade games with anybody. Actually, one other kid he could trade games with, and it was just like that kind of put this. Like, I think that kind of scorned him a little bit. And ever since, he's had this extreme passion for the NES because it was like he didn't have it back in the day.
No, even though, I mean, Choplift on the. And the Sega Master System was amazing. It really was
great games, definitely. We played the hell out of Reggie Jackson Baseball.
Yeah. Oh God. Yeah. But there were some really good games on that machine. But like I said, by the time it arrived, the Amiga and the 16-bit computers had arrived. The natural evolution from the 8-bits onto the 16s. So the reason I'm saying this, and the reason there's a relevance to what I'm talking about is, so when I see your titles like Haunted Halloween, and when I first started watching speedrunners on Twitch for a little bit, and then I started watching just retro game people playing retro games on Twitch, and I do it myself. And I don't emulate it. I actually put my consoles and I shove them through an upscaler and then just, you know, broadcast it. It's awesome.
Yeah.
And, you know, holding the actual controllers, even if they're terrible. In fact, especially if they're terrible.
Right.
Well, this is all they freaking had. This is all they had. I mean, they being our past selves. We didn't know any better. We had to have these terrible joysticks because that's all we had. And that's my argument. Like, I could see it with a nice, glorious sort of, you know, Mega Drive D-pad on my Spectrum, but that's ridiculous. It's heretical.
Give me a D-pad and two buttons and I'm fine.
Yeah, whereas on the Spectrum, it was like this big, big, fat sort of horrible joysticks that barely moved or were just poorly made. But my point is, the power of the NES is amazing, even to this day. If you look at what it can do and what it could do back then and the kind of games it made, and it lent itself to side-scrolling platformers. It really did. However, there were some wonderful other games and titles that were that appeared on those. That's what really gets me excited about what you're doing and what others are doing. Well, it's just that you're going, you know, this has still got legs. Yes, it's 30 years old. This hardware is 30 years old, but the kick is, or the trick really, is that it was designed and released at the end of the 8-bit era. That's really important. I know you probably don't understand it. Maybe you do understand it or appreciate it now because you've studied this, but it was at the end.
Yeah.
Because the height of it was in the early 80s. This is towards the end, the 86, 87 sort of era. It was like, this is the best we could squeeze out of this bloody processor. It's the best we could do. And look at it. It sings. So I want you to now to tell me how you made the NES sing, as you have done in the last couple of years, by the creating these haunted Halloween games. Please tell us about them.
Well, I think that part of it is that, so we made 85 and we had, you know, no idea what we were doing. We'd never made a game of any sort before. We'd never programmed anything before. And the only person that had actually done anything like this was our main programmer, Damien, who came on a little bit later in the creative process. So Tim and I kind of dreamed up the game. We knew we wanted to make it, and it took us a while, a couple years to like figure to learn everything and put our team together basically. And we brought Zach on, who does the backgrounds, and Thomas came on, who does the sound, and then Damien came on board. And from that point on, everything just kind of took off. So we were learning as we went and figuring out how to create assets that, you know, Damien could then code for. And, you know, I would make like a GIF of what we wanted to see happen, and then we'd create the assets accordingly, and then Damien would code it, and he's like spot on with what we had hoped for. So we were just kind of learning how to work together, and then making 86 as a direct sequel, that really allowed us to start pushing the limits, because we had a better understanding of the game, of the series, of what we wanted to do with it, where we wanted to go, and we knew the hardware restrictions much better by that point. So we could start getting more efficient with creating the sprites. Like I created most of the sprites and had learned how to make some of them just 2-frame animations instead of 3 or 4 frame animations. And when you're coding for something like the NES, you know, every bit is important and you really have to be efficient in everything that you do. And it can be a curse, but it's also what gives it the charm, where it's not limitless. You can't do anything you want. If you have an idea, you have to really be pragmatic about it and say like, okay, what's the trade-off? Everything you come up with, it's like, what's the trade-off? What gets cut in order to make this thing happen? And so That was one of the things that kind of drove us, was like a motivating force to see how much we could put into the game and like cram into 86 that we weren't able to put into 85 and make a bigger and better game in every category. So that was like our main goal, to really try to push with 86.
Yeah, because with a NES, if you've got a memory leak, that's catastrophic. Utterly catastrophic. Like
absolutely.
Where's that gone? Oh, where's it all stopped? Whereas modern games, you'd be playing 2 or 3 hours because you and I probably sit in front of computers with gigabytes of RAM, right? So it's slowing down. Why is it slowing? Oh, it suddenly filled my memory after 3 or 4 hours of play. You know, because and many games ship with these memory leaks going, oh, come on, it's trickling.
Right. You don't get that that luxury with the NES. You can't ship a game like that. There's no such thing as a patch. So you whatever you put on the cartridge is it.
It was something very, very rare occurrence back then. Even with the computers, that the games would be patched, quote unquote. Very, very rare. Mm-hmm. Not because the programming was better or anything like that. Maybe it was. Maybe it wasn't. Probably unlikely, actually. is because they had nothing to work with. Nothing. So yeah. The chasing of the, well, say nothing, very little. Much less.
Very little. So they had nothing compared to what we're looking at today.
Yeah, so they had to chase down this every line of code, and I mean just numbers, not words, because that's the nice bit, that probably the REM statement at the beginning saying, here it is. but, you know, I mean, there were compilers and stuff like that. It's quite common for actually, back in the day, they would write this stuff in a higher level language, then compile it, and then squeeze it into the machine that they're actually going to run it on. I mean, you know, it's so, you know, they would use TRS-80s or something, or much, much more powerful sort of computers to actually type the code. And then they would compile it and shove it into the computer that they were going to run the game on. Weird as that sounds.
Which some people actually do today. There's some tutorials out there for programming in C and then compiling it down.
Yeah.
The problem is, like what we're saying, it's just not as efficient. So you can only make like a small game doing something like that, whereas, you know, coding directly for the chip opens it all up.
Exactly, because compiling this still, it's very close. Don't get me wrong. I'm not going to, you know, sort of dumb it down, I said, but it's still not as close as actually telling the computer what to do with one switch versus the other, which is mind-numbing in many regards. It really is.
Yeah.
It is.
I agree. And coming from like a totally different background, this was all so fascinating to me as I was learning it. I was like, we are communicating directly with this chip. Like this is, you know, I'd love to be able to take like a legit college course or something on this where somebody with a lot of knowledge could lay it out for me and take me through step by step, like how exactly all of this stuff is working, because it's insane to me.
The trick is that who writes assembly now? Who does this now for modern machines? Well, it's driver writers. People who make the drivers that we all know and love and curse at and say, oh, got another update. Right. Well, that's why. That's why, because they're hitting the hardware. They have to. I mean, the OS developers, those, it's them. They're the ones left. the ones doing that. The low-level stuff. The people who make the BIOSes. Them.
Yeah.
They're the ones doing it.
I've heard of other homebrewers who have done that, been able to find programmers, 6502 programmers, who were doing something totally different. Because like what you're saying, they're working on physical hardware or used to work on physical hardware somewhere along the line.
Yeah.
And so it's easier for them to be like, okay, I know 6502. Let me just learn some of the nuances of the NES, and I can start to work with this.
Yeah, and like I said, it's listeners. I mean, we've got a lot of listeners, and we do talk about, you know, we do have a heavy bias in the UK, which is why I wanted to bring you across, because I want you to talk about what you've made here, because it's important, because at the moment we have a thriving community for all the 8-bit computers, which you probably know about and have interacted with.
I love learning about it. I'm just not as familiar, because we don't have a lot of those things over here. There's a ton of stuff that just never made it to the States.
No, but even still, now when I meet people like yourself at PAX, and you know what a Spectrum is. You know, 10 years ago, no idea. But now, we know what that is. Don't have one. Want one. You know?
right. Really, same thing with the Amiga. Had never heard of the Amiga, had never heard of it. The only thing I knew was the Commodore 64. Other than that, I didn't know anything about anything over there.
It's like a big can of worms. Like, they were doing what? And you realize that, you know, who made GTA? Well, British people. How did they make the... Oh, God. I mean, you see, you read stories about they had 700 games on the NES, whereas they are, and this is not an exaggerated number, this is an actual logged number, over 10,000 on the Spectrum. Oh, that's not an exaggeration. That's a genuine number backed up by a database saying, we had 10,000.
Were there no protections? Like, could anybody make a game for it? That just seems unreal.
Yeah. That's the point, because the games weren't made on cartridge like they were on the NES. It was all on audio tape. So you just put it on. And the game, because the baud rate, it's a bit boring here, but actually, no, it's not. Our listeners like this stuff. The baud rate the baud rate on the Spectrum for sound transmission, for the program transmission, was really high, really fast. Insanely fast. So you hear about stories about people loading software taking 20 minutes, 5 It was 5 minutes on the Spectrum. So it's still a little time, but nowhere near as bad as any other machine out there. It would squeeze it, and it would always load. The reliability was incredible, really good. And because of that, you know, you had people with a computer writing stuff, recording it onto an audio tape, and then sending it off in jiffy bags. And it's just created this cottage industry, and then exploded into a regular sort of full-blown sort of video game sort of industry, then turned into a nation of video game creators.
Yeah, that's awesome. Is there anybody out there that has a complete collection? Like, are all of these games cataloged somewhere?
Yeah, they are cataloged, but no one's really got them all. You can't. That's both the sad and beauty of it. It's like, no, I don't think everyone's ever got them all. They've got been close. They've gathered, like, you know, collections of houses, of software houses. That's what they're called back then. Not publishers. They're called software houses. And they, like, oh, yes, you know, like, I've got all the Ultimate Play the Game games, you know, because now known as Rare, they were called Ultimate back then. And, you know, they made, far as you know, they made Battletoads, right? Right?
Right, right.
But you now know that before that, they were doing loads of other stuff. You know, they made Jetpack.
I'd love to see that stuff.
Yeah, so it's just amazing what that happened there. But it's something that we're now learning from each other, that we both sort of, you know, both groups, and I mean North American and Europeans and Australians and Australasia as well, they had a kind of a hybrid experience. They had NES intermingled with the computers, so they had a bit of a slosh around, because that's what happened in Australasia. But when it comes to North America and Europe, and that kind of thing is really fascinating to me to see how powerful the NES turned out to be compared to these games, to these other systems, and having you making the NES Sing, and indeed other platforms of similar ilk, is quite important. And what I'm now going to delve into with you is how the design of the Haunted Halloween titles, which are, you know, they use, there's certain aspects of it that they're side-scrolling platformers, really, but there's a lot of combat going on, and there seems to be a lot of current design sympathies going on in the game. I mean, it doesn't feel like it was made 30 years ago. It feels like it was made a couple of years ago. It just happens to be on a NES. What do you think are the key aspects of the NES, key aspects of the game design of the Halloween titles that has been influenced by current game design? What do you think it is?
Well, I think the two main things that jump out are, we wanted to keep a clean interface, so there's no HUD, and you know that HUDs are classic in the NES era. So what we did was put the damage system, or the health system, on the skin of the characters in both games. So when you take damage, you go from like your normal skin color to a little bit paler, then you start turning green, then you turn dark green, and then you turn into a zombie. It was sort of a way to eliminate the traditional health meter by giving you that sort of visual cue on the skin of the character, which is something that exists in modern games. But to my knowledge, I don't think that existed back in the NES era, at least on the NES itself. I could be mistaken, but the way that we do it is, I think, pretty unique. Another thing is hiding the grid, where, you know, everything is tile-based, so there's usually a very rigid grid that everybody follows. Like, you know, Super Mario, everything's built in these 16 by 16 pixel blocks, and you see the grid as you go along. But Zach gets most of the credit for this. His artistic style, he was able to learn how to share colors across the four different background palettes that you get, so that you could hide the grid and give the game sort of a nice depth to it, where it's not just like here's the foreground and then the extreme background, but where you have the foreground and it continuously flows into a sort of near background and then the distant background, and the whole time we're trying to hide the classic grid so that the game just kind of takes on its own feel.
So yeah, bit of visual trickery, parallax scrolling as it was known back then, on an 8-bit machine. Like, what are you doing?
Right. 16, well, and so that comes from the fact that the NES, it only has one background. I mean, technically, I guess it has two. You have like your universal background color, and then you have your background. But you can't make one background scroll at a different rate, like one layer scroll at a different rate. You have to do screen splits. Again, one of the advancements we did from 85 to 86, we upgraded the memory mapper to the MMC3, which has a scan line counter in it. And that allowed us to, you know, you count down so many scan lines and you start scrolling at a different speed, and that's what creates the illusion of parallaxing.
Yeah, it's so smooth. And how did you remove this flickering on the sprites? It doesn't flicker. It's weird.
It's there, but it's more about like the careful placement of enemies, only so many show up on the same scan line. You get 8 sprites per scan line before you start getting flickering. So when you get to that 9th sprite, you know, it will no longer be drawn is the way that it works. So you trade off which of the 9 sprites gets drawn so that it flickers instead of just the 9th sprite not showing up at all.
Right.
And, you know, that's another trick that Damien was good at doing, programming to account for flickering when it does happen. And then it was up to us to only drop in enemies at the right intervals in the right places so that it doesn't get extreme flicker and extreme slowdown.
Charlie and I were out the back when Vera and Dave came by and said, come along and listen to our new podcast. And I was going to, but Charlie said, he says I shouldn't listen to strange people or imposters, and that I should only listen to the UK's number one retro gaming podcast, the Retro Asylum podcast.
It's really, really impressive, and I can't express to everyone out there, get a hold of a copy. It's just stunning to play and to experience. And it, I play a lot of indie games and stuff on, I'm sure you do, on Steam. I mean, one of the things that I do say to people is, oh, you just play retro games. No. In fact, we were just talking about, you know, before we started recording, I finished Horizon Zero Dawn over the Christmas. It was great. It took 50 hours, though, but yeah, it was great. And we, you know, you and I both have a huge affection towards games, regardless of when they were made, just to be clear.
Happen to be like, this is the era we grew up on, and this is what I love the most. And I think what our team loves the most is this 8 and 16-bit era. So yeah, the new era is fantastic.
It's ridiculous.
Some of it is just mind blowing.
Yeah.
But for us, this is where, you know, our heart's in this. So you know, this is what we want to do.
So I want to ask you about the character switching. Because I have an enthusiasm for game design. You probably hear it.
Cool.
I've mentioned it a couple of times now. And I think it's a understated skill. People don't really understand what we mean by game design. It implies people, you just level design. No. We're talking about the act of designing a game with a capital D. What is that whole, you know, from beginning to end, how did you come up with the design that you have? So it's a fascinating concept of switching between characters. And I remember I've encountered it for most of my game history, is that certainly in the mid-80s, there's sort of a lot of games where you either controlled multiple characters or the character that you controlled would switch between the two. How did it come about for you, and why is it there for the Halloween games?
Well, I don't want to spoil 85 for anybody who hasn't played it, but you get to meet Tammy. So Donnie is the main character, and then at the end you get to meet Tammy. And we knew from the very beginning that we wanted to include Tammy in 86.
Yeah.
And so we were thinking, like, okay, is there any way we could make this a co-op? And it's one of those things where the amount of detail that we wanted to put in the characters requires overlaying tiles. And so we're putting more tiles on screen for just our main characters than a lot of the games out there, than like your classic Mario. But what that does, that means that if we were to have both of them on screen at once, we would only have enough room per scan line for one enemy at a time before we start getting flickering. And it was it was, again, a trade-off. One of those things that we had to say, do we want to make this co-op just for the sake of making it co-op, or is there something else we could do? And then we came up with the idea of swapping back and forth between the two. And that was just sort of like, okay, that feels right. This seems like it would make sense. We'll give them separate health systems so that there's a reason to swap back and forth between the two. We'll make their move set a little bit different. The commands are all the same, but the moves, like Donnie's are punching based and Tammy's are kicking based, and she's a little bit quicker and can jump a little bit higher. Some of Donnie's punches are a little bit stronger, and so we kind of gave it a little bit of a trade-off there. And the main thing was, when you hit select to swap between the characters, we needed to have all of the frames of the off-screen character loaded into memory and ready to go so that we could swap them in as soon as you hit select. And that was a huge trade-off, because that meant less room for other enemies to be ready, you know, loaded into RAM and ready to go. And so there's that like 1 second delay when you hit select, everything pauses for a second, but all momentum is preserved, and like the entire game state is preserved, so that once that second is over, it carries over naturally. And we felt like that was a reasonable trade-off, to be able to have both characters their all their key animation frames loaded into RAM so that you could swap back and forth continuously without having to do something like hit start, go to a menu, select the other character, and then start the game again. We didn't want to pull you away from the action, but we feel like that brief pause actually gives you a moment to breathe, and you can assess the situation a little bit, and you can whatever you were doing, you continue your momentum, and you can combo right out of the swap when you tag in the other characters. So in the end, we felt like that was the best of all the possibilities. We felt like that was the best route to take.
And it's just all this talk about the controls and stuff, I'm going to go and touch on that in a moment now, but it's just, I found it really quite modern to have that.
Like idea. The amount of moves you can do and stuff like that?
Switching between one character and the other.
That
was just like, this feels like a, you know, contemporary indie game now. It always does anyway when I play it, but even still, I'm talking about the 86 game, of course. It doesn't happen in the first one, because it definitely your first is almost like a first foray into the realms of making games on a what we regarded as a dead platform, in inverted commas. But
I think you can see that in 85. I think you can see, like, we're just learning what we're doing, and we had to keep the game simple because, you know, we like I said, we're just learning. We're trying to figure this stuff out. And then with 86, we felt like we could push a little bit more and introduce things like we've talked about on here. Some of the move sets, like all the different, you know, like down, forward, and B to do a move. Okay, everybody knows that and accepts it for a Street Fighter style game or something. But on the NES, you know, when we tell people, okay, you know, press down, forward, B to do this forward dash attack, and they're like, what, on an NES? Like, I'm doing combos and moves and that. Yeah. So that was another thing that I think we took from modern gaming, was like, let's try to get things in there, like pressing up to do a dodge, and just some things that might be a little bit counterintuitive at first, but from the feedback that we've gotten, people seem to take to them.
When you have that controller, it's a tiny little gray thing. It's not particularly ergonomically, you know, pleasant.
No, not at all.
It's not, but you know, it's still only a D-pad, two little buttons in the middle, and two other buttons. That's all you got. Just it.
Yep.
You know, and I don't know if you know this, but there is Elite, which is a celebrated game from the 80s, did actually appear on the NES, but only in Europe. And I've played it. I've streamed it over Twitch. It's an amazing feat. Normally that game requires a full computer keyboard to play, but they managed to get that and put it into the controller by simply using menus. That's all they did. Used menus, and the whole interface flows, and it's beautiful.
Yeah, and you said it's called Elite?
Elite, yes. So Elite
I'm
is like
with that. I'll have to check it out.
Elite is like the one of the earliest sandbox games, like, you know, going back to GTA and that kind of thing. The open world games like the Breath of the Wild, Zelda, you know, you can trace the heritage back to games like Elite, which is basically, you know, you flying across space And they re-released it recently as a new game called Elite Dangerous. This is excellent too, but you're just actually flying through space and you're just trading and fighting pirates and do what you like. You know, just what can you do? Oh, let's go. So, and this is back in the day of, you know, this is many, many years ago. So, and that innovation that because here we are with controllers that you and I have been grown up with controllers over decades, right? So when we're faced with a PlayStation 4 controller, we think nothing of it. Okay, we think, oh, okay, what's the controls on this? Oh, you know, we know that in many times now, half, maybe two-thirds of the buttons on that thing are ignored. In many games, it's just like, oh, is it a twin stick shooter? Oh, okay. Like next machina, you know, it's like, oh, it's just twin sticks, right? Okay. And look, to you and I, that's fine. But when you put it in someone's hands, just not familiar, you know, hasn't been around games, it's just like reintroduced. It's horrifying. It's just like, what are all these buttons for? I don't worry about those.
Right.
Don't worry about those. Just use that. Go on. They might hold it upside down. Like, no, it's this way. What are you doing? And we can't empathize. We're the worst. Because we're like, what are you, some sort of moron? No, they're not. They just don't know. They just haven't been around these controllers. Because we've seen them evolve over 30 years to the monsters they are now. And I do mean that. I mean, Sony and Microsoft may deny it, but they are genuinely monstrous. When you look at the NES controller, NES controller, and then SNES controller as well, they're so simple. There's not a lot to them, and that's really empowering, because what you've done is you've had to, like, well, we've only got these buttons, but we want to do this stuff on the screen. What do we do? Well, why don't we just double tap stuff and make them do combos, because these buttons can work with each other, can't they? I mean, a D-pad can work. And
down plus B and down forward plus B and up down A B at the same time, hammer on them. Like, that's one of the moves in the game, and that's something that's we could have, like, when we took it to Steam on the PC version, we could have just made that the Y button or the right shoulder button or anything like that. That seemed to, like, cheapen it a bit, I guess. Like, we wanted people to play it as if they were holding just the classic NES controller.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. You just, you're right. You could have gone to, oh, look, finally we were liberated. We can just go back to our 14 button monsters that we all know and are used to. Okay. Well, just Y, shoulder button. Even the joystick have buttons. The thumb,
right. Everything's pressure sensitive, and it's just crazy.
It's just like, well, come on. So, you know, it's just that's, and I tip my hat to you and your colleagues that you made this and you embraced the fact that, no, we're not going to cheap out on this. We're not going to, you know, go, okay, well, we'll just, you know, to convert it into whatever. Let's just say this is all we've got. You know, this is all we've got, and that's.
If you want to check out another game that does that, and I think does it really well, a game called Star Versus. Dustin is a guy who made it, and a really good dude. And he one of his missions setting out to make the game was like giving all of these controls with just the simple D-pad and, you know, start, select A and B. And I think they pull it off magnificently.
Retro Asylum, a shadowy flight into the dangerous world of reviewing games on systems that no longer exist. Team of not-so-young loaders on a crusade to champion the cause of the gamer, the helpless, the powerless, in a world of programmers and publishers who operate above the law. We'll be right back.
I've got another question for you, because we've spoken a lot about your past, but let's talk about a little about the future now, because I'm right in thinking you're making a new game, or on the brink of, or it's Full Quiet. Is that right? Or is that?
Yeah, correct. That's the new game that we are currently working on, yeah.
Okay, can you tell us a little bit about it? Because it's a very different game, isn't it?
Very different. It's still a platformer. I think we just have an obsession with platformers, but it's not the beat 'em up style. It's not like high flying, beat everything up that you see sort of game. So you're a guy, and something takes your son, and you've got to go out and find your son. That's the basic premise of the game. So you're going to venture off into the woods, and you're going to have to learn along the way. It's going to be more of like a mystery, a little bit of survival, some action for sure. You're going to be shooting things that you find, but not everything. That you don't kill everything that you see. So you've got to figure out puzzles, and it's just going to be a different experience. It's going to be all more about open exploration than just about like nonstop action.
And it feels like some of the I get the atmosphere from it. It feels a bit like Firewatch and that kind of like walking simulator like thing, which I don't like calling them that, but you know what I mean. It's more of a There's a lot of more narrative going on. Am I right in thinking that?
There is. I haven't played Firewatch, so I'm not too familiar with it. But I guess it's like some of the imagery that we have. It's reminding people of Firewatch, because definitely more than one person has said that to us. So yeah. I can't really comment on Firewatch, but the game is more about, like I said, like exploration, like making your way out into the woods and encountering these weird enigmatic creatures and figuring out how to handle them, who to kill, like what to try to do, how do you solve these puzzles. Like basically you're put into this world and we want you to have to figure out like what the hell is going on.
Right. That's a bit Zelda-like, really, because that's how the original Zelda, it's like, off you go. It's dangerous out there. Take this.
Right. Here you go. Right, that's it. They don't even start you with the sword. You technically could just walk off in another direction and not even go get the sword, and then you're just completely screwed.
Yeah.
But luckily the doorway's right there, and you go get your nice sword, and okay, here you are. You're an underpowered little elf. Now go try to figure this out.
Called Link, by the way.
Right.
God. Zelda's this princess. Anyway. Excellent. So when's that out? Is it next year, isn't it, something? You got a little while ago, haven't you, on that?
Yeah, because we're trying to do some things with this game that we've never done before. Like I said, we just want to continue to learn and improve and hone our craft. So we were trying to give ourselves a full year to make this.
Yeah. Back in the day, they had weeks, but, you know, that's just not how that works. This is the question that definitely our listeners want to ask you, because if they were here, so I have to speak for them. As we've already hinted at banging on about other platforms, which you've recognised and know they are around, would you ever consider porting your titles to other 8-bit platforms?
We would love to do that. I guess the main thing is finding programmers that we can work with, because we wouldn't have time to sit down and try to learn how to program for some of these other consoles.
I think so, it would be ideal is just have a license. Like, here's the game. You make it, and then we'd have a shared sort of profit or something.
We're open to any sort of ideas. I guess, like I continue to say, we're new to all of this, so we're just trying to learn. And if people have ideas, we're open to listen and brainstorm and think about what we can do. We'd love to take the Haunted series to other platforms. We'd love to be able to make a 16-bit version of a Haunted series one day, whether it's just directly porting a game or continuing the series on another platform. It's wide open, so we don't want to limit ourselves, but we know that like our passion is the NES, and that's what we want to continue to make games for. So we feel like we'll start all of our games, any series we make will start on the NES, and then wherever it goes from there, we'll just have to see.
I think there's definitely potential for you to sort of linking up with C64 Amstrad and Spectrum developers who do exist and are working on games to this day, and say, look, we've got this. Could you like do a version? And it won't be the same. I can promise you that. You might go, why can't? Because, for example, listen to this. The Spectrum doesn't have any hardware sprites. Just let that sink in for a moment. So,
okay.
So it has no hardware sprite. So the whole sprite thing you were talking about doesn't really apply. It's a different technology that you use.
Where do you even start then with that? We'd be back to square one.
Yes, you would. You basically said, wait, everything we'd learned, it's rubbish. And then you have to start again. So every little pixel, I'm not kidding, you have to plot. then move.
If we could team up with the right people, that would be awesome. And I would love to learn that stuff. Love to learn it.
I think you get a lot of credence, or credit from people going, wow, you've done it. You've actually said, let's make this game and spread it to other platforms. It would be lovely. So if we can help with that, we know a lot of people over here, and we could link you up with that. And then, because I think there's definite potential for, and it would be a wonderful sort of link between the two sort of regions, and say, look, well, we didn't make Spectrum games. We'd love to have done, but we didn't. Yeah. And now you've got Halloween running on a Speccy or a BBC or an Amstrad or a C64 or what have you. Insert myriad of other platforms, but they're the ones that people are most sort of comforted by, and the Amiga as well, and of course the Atari ST. And they'll do a fine job of running Halloween games, and indeed Fall Quiet when it arrives. It will be, I think there's definitely something there, and there's something that it would be folly for me to not bring up, because it's fascinating to see what people could do. Like, okay, they've done that. Let's do this. And what many times when back in the day they would port the games, and it would, they would change it to exploit a certain aspect of this machine. Like, but that's not the original game. Yeah, but isn't it awesome? Like, oh yeah.
As long as the core of the game is still intact, then that would be really cool. I had never really thought about this, never considered it much of a possibility, but the Commodore 1702 video monitor, that's my monitor. That's what I use. I love running the NES through that, and to actually have a Commodore game, like one of our Commodore games running through there, that would blow my mind.
Yeah, and like I said, there are developers out there, and of course – you probably don't know this. I think I did talk to you about it at PAX last year, but they're making a new Spectrum. So the Spectrum died 30 years ago. So they're making the Spectrum Next, which is a new Spectrum, which uses, fairly modern chips, but they're FPGA, so they're sort of reconfigured. And it's still a Spectrum in its core, but it's been spruced up and, jazzed up and stuff. So there's definitely potential of, we talked about the NES being, or the NES being the end of the 8-bit life. Well, this is kind of like the phoenix from the flames. The Spectrum, they're basically taking the technology and understanding and knowledge we have now about the Z80 chip and expanding it even more to do things, even more crazy things. It almost looks like a 16-bit machine, but it's not. And people are making games for that. It's got over 1 megabyte of RAM. I know, right? So it's an 8-bit machine with 1 megabyte, which can address all that memory, by the way. So it has a bus that can actually see all that memory. Imagine it. Imagine that. So you could
I saw that probably about 6 months ago is the last time I've really looked into that. It looks fantastic. I haven't heard much about is there a community of developers getting behind it or anything? That would be great. Really, I think the machine is beautiful looking.
Yes, it's going to come out in Easter. There's been a bit of a delay for reasons, but it's coming out in Easter. The boards are already out. The bare boards are already out. People are making games on it because they've got the bare, chip set, sort of like, and they're putting it in various sort of cases and stuff. But the official launch, or the official one with the cases and everything, that's coming out in a couple of months from now. Very exciting.
You said 1 meg of RAM on board?
Yeah.
Think yeah, that's it. Huge.
It's huge.
That's, I mean,
for an 8-bit machine, that's obscene. Yeah. It's an obscene amount of memory. I can't even
imagine what we do. But so is this the same as the original, where you're saying there are no sprites? There's no hardware sprites?
In the you can run original Spectrum games and Spectrum systems on it, but it's a new spectrum. So the new, if you're running it on the new spectrum, so I'd expect the Halloween games maybe in two versions. I'd have the original Spectrum version and then the Spectrum Next version. The Spectrum Next does have hardware sprites.
Wow! Yeah, that's fascinating.
It has things. It has the Commodore SID chip emulated on it, and things like this, which is many people in the Spectrum community going, "That's heretical," because there is a rivalry between the two systems.
Right,
really big problem in the UK. It's a massive rivalry between the two systems. So when you had like, "Oh yeah, we're just going to put the sound," no, don't do that. It's heretical. Like, but it sounds awesome. True. Okay, we'll leave it. like I said, in answer to your question, yes, there is a very strong community making games for the Spectrum. It has its own built-in assembler. Okay. So you actually know that part of that work has been simplified because it's got its built-in assembler. Imagine.
Okay. Thing sounds fantastic.
It is. So it's in a. So there is that option of, and there is, like I said, there's a very strong community of developers, and they're doing little demos on Facebook, and every now and again, they go, "I've got this to move. Look, and it's just lovely. Yeah. Like, look, I've got that to move."
That's how I started with the Nerdy Knights tutorial. Yeah. You know, you get got our in 85 got like the library scene loaded in, got all the attribute tables to line up and everything, and then got our first sprite in there, and I was moving it around on the NES, you know, looking at it move on the TV, and I'm like jumping around. I'm like, this is the best thing I've ever done. I like sent a video of it to everyone, like, we're on our way, you know, we're doing this. And it was just one sprite moving around the screen.
Doesn't matter. It's just like the mere.
So
you
excited.
You put that sprite on there. It's so empowering. You know, it's just like, but it's just a blob. That's not just a blob. That's six
that's
months' work.
I did that.
It's my blob. That's some serious maths. It really is, everyone. You know, they talk about developers and nowadays they say, oh, you don't need complex maths for programming. It's true. You don't need to know calculus and other sort of rather complex abstract mathematical ideas, which are just a series of patterns, by the way, not numbers. Whereas when it comes to programming in assembly, yes, you do. Your brain needs to do ridiculous gymnastics to figure out what's going on.
And do it in hex.
No. This is a series of meaningless numbers and letters. But, you know, like I said, we've gone full circle, which is wonderful. I love doing that in conversations because that means we're coming to an end, which is sad because it's been great chatting to you, Greg. But
absolutely.
I want to know, how can people purchase or buy Haunted Halloween and your other titles? Can they still buy the cartridges? Because we haven't really spoken about that. They come in great. Well, I know I've seen it. The Halloween 86 comes in this bright orange sort of red thing cartridge, which is a NES cartridge. Can they still buy this?
Yeah, absolutely. So the cheapest option is on Steam, and for people that don't have, you know, working NES consoles. And then for those who do, you can go to our website. It's cashinculture.com, and everything's available on there. Or go to our social media, Retrotainment, at Retrotainment HQ on Twitter, or find us on Facebook. If you just get in contact with us in any way online, we can point you to where you can pick up the actual cartridges.
Fantastic. And just to be clear, the dreadful PAL versus NTSC thing, you've managed to override that, haven't you?
The games will play. The problem is the refresh rate, jumping from 60 hertz to 50 hertz. It makes the games play a little bit slower, and it pitch shifts the audio a little bit. So it's not the true experience. It would take a good bit of work for us to go back in and rewrite things for the 50 hertz refresh rate of PAL. Not that it can't be done, but we don't know if there's a big enough audience out there for it for that to be done. So it's the easiest thing is to grab it on Steam, or if you can get your hands on an NTSC NES, that would be ideal.
Yeah. It's just, you know, back in the day, all of our games were 15% slower, and they were squished.
That's how it goes sometimes, right?
It's how it was. You know, for me, when I'm playing, you know, the original Sonic, you know, the music's just when I play, hear the NTSC version, like, I can't What? It's too fast. What do you mean? Can we just calm down just a little?
Yeah, dial it back a little, yeah.
Can we just dial it back and have the jazz version of it?
We also have Famicom cartridges available. I don't know if that helps, if you guys see many Famicom systems in the UK, but we did port them to Famicom and did Japanese translations. So if you want to play the game entirely in Japanese and you got a Famicom, there's an option for that.
That's cool. And what do you make of the mini consoles? I mean, they came out of nowhere, didn't they? I did not see Nintendo doing this. And what do you make of it all? I mean, there must have been an opinion on it.
Yeah, it's cool. Just cool to see these games continue, to see the lifespan of the NES and the games made for it continue. A lot of homebrewers around the community were a little bit nervous about this. Like, is this going to like kind of ruin what we're doing? And it's just one of those things that like it brings attention to what we love, and I think that's fantastic. And the way people hack them and then put 700 games on there and are playing it. Like, anytime you give something like that to the community, you know, people are just gonna like hack into it and figure out how to make it even better. And I just love to see all of this stuff continue to happen. All of this technology is fascinating to me. The way that people are preserving these old systems is fascinating. Like we talked about, the difference between cultures, like what was popular in your region, what was popular in Australia, what was popular in South America. Yeah. Like the history of all of these things is so fascinating to me. So for me, I just love everything about it.
And of course, the internet's made the world drink. And brought people like you and I together, and it's like, we played this game, we did this, and I have no idea what it is, but it sounds awesome. What is it?
Yeah, and that's what I love about this community, this homebrew community for the NES. Like, everybody has all these great ideas and wants to do different things, and we just kind of collaborate, and we get to meet at these conventions and talk about things, and like you're talking about, oh, I thought this thing was something totally different back in the day, and you just learn all these little quirks and nuances about the community and the console, and again, it's just all so fascinating to me.
Yeah. Well, Greg, it's been fantastic having you on Retro Asylum. Really, really
thank you very much.
Talk about your quest to make games on a machine that many regard as very, very dead, but it is not.
it's very much
alive and kicking, and it's just wonderful to see these games that, I mean, when I first saw it at PAX, I'm like, wait, this has got to be some sort of because I initially thought you were an indie developer for modern titles, a modern machine, and you're just using it's just like, oh yes, this game looks like a NES, and then I realized, no, you're actually playing it on a console. I'm like, okay, I got that wrong. I'm so sorry, Greg, but you know, you're in the midst of the indie booth. What am I supposed to do? You know, because you're not.
No, we assume that most people think it's not legit, and most people are like, "Wait, is this actually playing on an NES?" And we're like, "Here's the NES console. Here's the cord running to the TV. Here's the controller coming out. You're playing the NES. There's no illusion here."
I remember seeing people trying to lift up the curtain underneath, or like, you've got a PC running underneath. You've got a little mini.
Right.
You've got a little Mac Mini or something running. No, really, we haven't. No, it's actually a regular. Oh wait, you've modded the NES. It's got RetroPie in there. No,
right.
No, we haven't.
Definitely a question we get a lot. Like, is there a RetroPie in there?
Yeah. No, because no, it's not. It's just a regular NES that's still working somehow.
it's great. This is something that the community as a whole we kind of deal with, is people that assuming that this stuff isn't real or that they're hacks. That's the other huge thing, is it like, okay, which game did you hack to make this? And it's like, no, the homebrew community, we build things from the ground up. It's all built from scratch.
And then when you talk to people, especially, no offense to listeners if you are in this age group, but people in their 20s, I'm sorry, what? You do what? But how did you? And then, especially if they're programmers or developers themselves, like, no, this is all assembly. What? And then run screaming from the hall, like, no, no, not dealing with that, because they have a bad enough time using high level languages. They don't want to deal with lots of strings of numbers and letters.
Yeah, there are a lot of, you know, 20s, even teens that are into this stuff. And we yes. love to see that, you know, especially people that kids like 10, 12 that show up with their parents and like their parents are into it. And then the kids start playing and they get into it. Like, that's great to see.
It's wonderful. Okay, well, we'll end it there. Greg, it's been fantastic having you on. You're more than welcome to come
back. Yeah,
thank
you very much.
More than welcome
anytime,
to come
Chris.
Back. Yeah, yeah, and just chat about Full Quiet when it arrives next year. But in the meantime, thanks very much.
Thank you.